The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. President Obama's nomination of Federal Appeals Court Judge Merrick Garland to replace Antonin Scalia on the Supreme Court will be a major issue in campaigns for the Senate and for president. We'll have a lot more on the primary results from last night and the state of America democracy coming up this hour. But we are taking a look at President Obama's pick for the Supreme Court. I was joined by Eric Citron. He's a partner at Goldstein & Russell, also a former clerk to Justices Sandra Day O'Connor and Elena Kagan, and a guest contributor to SCOTUS Blog.
Chief Judge Garland of the D.C. Circuit is a moderate, extremely thoughtful, extremely smart judge who is, you know, extraordinarily fair to the litigants in front of him and, you know, one of the most likely people to call cases right down the middle and to be very responsive to the arguments that the people are making before him. I actually am preparing a case that was supposed to be before him on a panel tomorrow morning. I'm not sure if he's going to show up for work or not after today's nomination. But, you know, he is the kind of judge anyone would be very happy to have their case in front of, because you know you're going to get someone who's both extraordinarily smart and extraordinarily fair.
And Eric Citron, you know, Merrick Garland was clearly moved during his remarks in the Rose Garden after being nominated. But what does it take for a judge like him to agree to this? He was attacked before he was even named officially. Why would someone like him enter a fight that's highly political with what appears to be very little chance he'll get a vote, much less be confirmed?
You know, I think there are two reasons. One is there is a chance that he will be confirmed. And as Judge Garland said, this is both a lifelong dream and the greatest, you know, possible public service that he could possibly imagine to provide. And so if there's even a small chance, he'd like to take it. At the same time, I would say, you know, this is not a call that you refuse, in part because when a president from either party calls on you to stand as a nominee for a job like this, it is itself a form of public service and one that Judge Garland is obviously honored to be a part of, to basically fulfill your role as a nominee. And so, you know, I think that he would be very unlikely to actually say no to the president.
Eric Citron, thanks for joining us.
For sure. Thank you for having me.
Eric Citron is a former clerk for Justices Sandra Day O'Connor and Elena Kagan. He's a guest contributor to SCOTUS Blog. Well, the president's nomination of Merrick Garland for the Supreme Court now goes to the Senate, where a GOP leadership and GOP rank and file says they won't even consider the nomination. David Herzenhorn is congressional reporter and my colleague from our partner, The New York Times. David, welcome.
Good to be with you.
Listen to the president in his own words talking about this nomination heading to the Senate.
To suggest that someone who has served his country with honor and dignity, with a distinguished track record of delivering justice for the American people, might be treated, as one Republican leader stated, as a political piñata? That can't be right.
David Herzenhorn, Chuck Schumer says if Merrick Garland can't get bipartisan support, no one can. What's the message to the GOP Senate here?
Well, the other important thing that we heard the president say was that if Republicans refuse to meet with Judge Garland, which is what many of them have said, that they would not even meet with any nominee sent up by the president because no action will be taken. Obama said this will show a judicial nomination process that is, quote unquote, beyond repair. And that's very significant. There's no question that Judge Garland, you said, is willing to accept this nomination because you have to have some faith in the system working one way or another. And in fact, Democrats will now step up their fight. The pressure has been on already for weeks, but it's been a very theoretical argument. Now they have a face, a name to put with their insistence that Republicans take action, and already you're seeing a substantial ratcheting up in the pressure. Patrick Leahy, the senior Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, has already put out a statement saying if you go by the normal time frame of past Supreme Court nominees, that a confirmation vote for Judge Garland should take place before Memorial Day, and he's urging the Senate to take that kind of swift action. So we'll see a lot of pressure. The president said Garland will be up at the Capitol beginning tomorrow. So we're certainly going to be here expecting his appearance and to see just how far Democrats go in sort of trying to draw out the theater of this. You know, will he be knocking on doors that won't be answered, or will they simply begin by bringing him in to meet with the Democrats and making it known that he's here in the Capitol building and Republicans are just not willing to speak to him?
David, the White House has made it known that seven sitting GOP senators, including Orrin Hatch, a couple of others, voted for Merrick Garland when he was nominated to the U.S. Appeals Court back in 1997. That's a pressure point for them as well here.
There's no question, and it may be a little bit misleading as folks look back at Garland's confirmation vote in 1997 and see that there were 23 votes against him. Many of those no votes were actually based on a larger fight that had nothing to do with him, which was really about the number of judges needed on the appellate court for the D.C. Circuit. And in fact, as you saw, Orrin Hatch, senator from Utah, a senior member of the Judiciary Committee, former chairman of that committee, saying very clearly he voted in favor of Garland, but saying at the time there's no one who could say that Garland was not qualified to sit on that appellate court. And I think we're going to hear those quotes on the Senate floor again and again and again in the coming weeks as Democrats remind everyone that, in fact, there was almost unanimous agreement about the qualifications of Judge Garland, even if there was disagreement over whether, in fact, there was a need for another judge on the appellate court.
David Herzenhorn, congressional reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
Any Supreme Court fight is almost guaranteed to have a big impact on the presidential campaign. We want you to play political consultant today. What advice do you have for your candidate after last night's primary results?
This is Andrew in Kalamazoo, Michigan. If I were a campaign manager, my advice would be you'll win or you'll go home, but don't bend your principles for politics. You'll have to face your family or your voters at the end of this.
Well, last night was the end for Florida Senator Marco Rubio after losing his home state to Donald Trump. And the end for Republicans could wind up being on the convention floor. The GOP is looking at the possibility of a contested convention in July. It would be the first time that's happened since 1976, when Ronald Reagan challenged sitting President Gerald Ford. After winning in Ohio last night, Governor John Kasich immediately turned around and hired consultants who were there in 1976. He wants their help at the July convention to try to take out Donald Trump. Joining us now is a Donald Trump supporter and a Democrat. He's Kenneth Lancey. He's founder of Consolidated Solutions, a business in Cleveland, Ohio. He's also creator of the Ohio Dems for Trump website. Welcome to The Takeaway, Kenneth.
Good to be here.
And so as a Democrat, what does that mean to you? Why are you over on Donald Trump's side?
Well, I've been a lifelong Democrat, and I'm a Kennedy Democrat. My parents were Roosevelt Democrats, and this is not my Democratic Party. Things have changed dramatically, and I have been thrust into the political arena 9 years ago when I had a cardiac arrest. As a result of that, there was more to do, is what I was told. And I saw that bright white light. I felt the love of God and was trying to figure out what that was. And 6 years ago, I ran for a county executive position, was a new position in Cuyahoga County. And everybody said, that's what I'm supposed to do. Once I got into politics, I realized how bad things were. And the more I learned about it, and the more convinced I was that I have to do something for the greater good of all. I then ran for mayor of Cleveland. I am a Democrat. I ran against a Democrat, and the Republican Party held a fundraiser for the other Democrat. So I know exactly what Donald's going through, because it's any politician except an outsider.
Let's talk about the campaign. Donald Trump has chosen a path so far in this campaign that includes incitement to violence, xenophobia, and some racism. Do you discount this? How do you react to the choices he's made to run this type of campaign?
Well, I'm not in full agreement, you know, with at times the attitude. However, he has been in a battle. He started out with 16 other candidates and was attacked from all sides. When I ran for mayor of Cleveland, I had no media coverage. They were. Whatever they did write, they didn't like the fact that I was orange, and they didn't like the fact that I drove an expensive car. And those were the things they wrote about. So, you know, you're always attacked, and it's up to you how you respond. Now, You know, I've been to the rallies. I've seen the protests. I think what happened in Chicago, and I know what happened in Chicago, is you have professional protesters, and it was for the benefit of the media. There are people that come in that heckle. Why they do it, I really don't know. I mean, at the end of the day, yes, freedom of speech, but why would you go into a room with a bunch of people that have a different view and just have to make noise and, you know, create problems, and then ultimately you can have chaos? You yell fire, you know, in a theater, you're going to have people stepping over each other.
Kenneth Lindsay, let me stop you there, because we both have watched the rallies. I wish I could punch him in the face. There was a time when people like that would leave on a stretcher. I'm going to pay the legal fees of the man who punched a black kid in the face on his way up the steps after being ejected. Donald Trump has made these choices. This is not because of protesters.
Mm-hmm. Well, his, you know, he is spontaneous, that's for sure. And he says, you know, what he's thinking at the moment. And, you know, it is a, as I said, I'm not 100% approving of the words he uses at the time, but I am convinced that his ability and his ability to have success representing our country in a very strong way, because at this particular point in time, this is a point in time in history that has never happened since the inception of the United States, where we are under a threat from a religion / nationality that whose sole purpose is to eliminate the people that think differently than they do. And that's everybody in the United States. That's everybody in Israel. And this is a different time. This is a different time that needs a different solution. Playing nice has got us absolutely nowhere over the last 7-8 years. And it is about the survival of America. It's not a Democrat or Republican. It really doesn't matter at this point. This is how do we save America? In my opinion.
I'm not sure that this administration, both political and career, has been playing nice with thousands of drone strikes and special operations against terrorists around the world. But I want to ask you about politics here at home. Your governor in Ohio, John Kasich, who did well last night, as we're going to hear later in the show, has set about hiring operatives to work for him in the event of a contested convention in Cleveland in July. And the math is looking increasingly like that's going to happen. Now, if that does happen and Donald Trump winds up losing this nomination after having a plurality of the delegates, how is that going to make you feel about your vote and the process?
Well, I'm going to be extremely disappointed in the process, because the people should have the opportunity to speak. And when the majority of the people want to have an individual represent them, and then the political process steps in and changes that, I don't think that was the original intention, okay, of our Constitution.
Millions of Republican voters are going to feel like you, and probably a lot worse than you do, since you're a lifelong Democrat, if Donald Trump winds up losing the nomination because of convention maneuvering.
Convention maneuvering. And this is really what politics is about. And that's the part that people are fed up with.
And we're going to see over the next few months what Republicans do ahead of their own convention in Cleveland. Kenneth Lindsay, a Democrat for Donald Trump, owner and founder of Consolidated Solutions. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Staples, with printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals. At Staples Stores or Staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
You want to vote for me? Great. You don't? That's okay. But what I do not want to see are billionaires spending unlimited sums of money and undermining the democracy which has made our country so great.
Seth from Hoboken, and I would advise Bernie Sanders to try to continue the political revolution and try to keep the electorate engaged. In important issues, his cause is way too important to only have legs and a voice during the election season.
If we let the pundits and the talking heads tell us how to run this campaign, we would have gotten out of this race on day 3. So Senator Sanders is in this to win this. There is a path to the nomination. That's what we intend to do. So we're not going to do Secretary Clinton any favors. Hey, hey.
That's Simone Sanders there. She's press secretary for the Bernie Sanders campaign. We're going to hear more from her in just a moment. If Republicans appear more than ever to be careening toward chaos at a convention this summer, Democrats may have gotten more clarity last night. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders lost to Hillary Clinton across the board in Ohio, Florida, North Carolina, and narrowly in Illinois, where the campaign had hoped to repeat last week's upset win in Michigan. Team Sanders now has to ask itself if it has a realistic shot at catching Hillary Clinton before the summer convention. But at the same time, the campaign is awash in money. $42 million raised by Sanders in February alone, meaning that any decision to stay in the race can be made on the merits, not with the pressure of money in mind.
Next week, Arizona has a very important election. We will win. We will win if the voter turnout is high. Let's make it high. Thank you all very much.
Senator Sanders speaking to supporters during a night of losses at a raucous rally in Phoenix, Arizona there. Simone Sanders is press secretary for the Bernie Sanders campaign. The numbers are not adding up for Bernie Sanders, but Simone says he's moving west and looking for votes.
We knew that the early map favored Secretary Clinton, and we expect that last night was the high watermark for her delegate lead. So we're still in this. This is going to be a very long nominating contest. You know, at the end of last night, you know where the senator was? He was with 65,000 excited supporters who have been waiting for hours because they're fired up to keep the political revolution rolling. So we're looking forward to the next set of nominating contests because this is going to be a very long fight.
But let's talk about what happened last night and leading up to last night, however, because after the big upset in Michigan, there was a lot of perceived momentum, I know, within the campaign and in the press about Senator Sanders' campaign. He drew some sharp contrasts over the last week when Secretary Clinton said that Nancy Reagan had been a positive force for AIDS in the 80s, angered a lot of her supporters. Senator Sanders came out against Rahm Emanuel, who's not popular at all in Chicago, thought that would help you all in Illinois. Turns out it wasn't quite enough.
Well, Senator Sanders has said from the moment the tapes became available from the Laquan McDonald investigation that anyone that knew about the tapes and that actively worked to suppress them, you know, any elected official should be held accountable. So he did not come out against Rahm Emanuel to bolster himself in this race. Senator Sanders was merely standing on the right side of the issue. Look, the struggle for equity in Chicago public schools is a real issue. Those are the things Senator Sanders was talking about, the need to make sure we hold our elected officials and our police departments accountable and make sure that they are working on behalf of the people are real issues, especially in Chicago.
The White House is appointing today for the Supreme Court. There's going to be a big fight over this nominee. He may never even reach the court. We all know that Republicans in the Senate are refusing to even consider that nomination. How do you think this alters the race? There is an educated school of thought that a Supreme Court fight favors Hillary only because, with many Democrats, Hillary is viewed as more electable. And the more they think about the future of the court and a divided court, the more they think, gosh, can't afford to lose the general election, have to go with the more electable person.
We exactly cannot afford to lose the general election, which is why if Democrats would like to keep the White House in 2016, 2017, you have to vote for Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is the most electable candidate in this race on the Democratic side. He beats Donald Trump by a larger margin than Secretary Clinton. And so that argument of electability, it is important. And Senator Sanders is the most electable Democrat in this race. Look, we believe that Senate Republicans need to do their job, and they should confirm President Obama's nominee to the Supreme Court.
Simone Sanders, you are looking towards the western states. Arizona is coming up. There is a chance Senator Sanders will perform better. Talk about the chessboard a little bit going forward and this narrow path now, the increasingly narrow path, it has to be said, that Senator Sanders has in order to challenge Hillary Clinton for the nomination.
Well, look, we are going to move to a more favorable calendar and start racking up real wins. So again, you just noted it only gets closer. So yes, Arizona is coming up. The senator was in Arizona last night, a 6,500 people crowd who were excited. They were electrified because they are ready to keep the political revolution moving forward.
no backing down from the campaign of Senator Bernie Sanders after a tough night last night, losses in Ohio, Illinois, Missouri, and Florida. Simone Sanders, press secretary for the Bernie Sanders campaign. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Y'all have a great day.
We've got one more trip around Ohio this coming fall where we will beat Hillary Clinton and I will become the president of the United States.
This is Cheryl from Arlington, Texas. Stay the course, John. You are the brightest and best hope for a solid conservative vote.
All hour long, we're getting advice from you for the candidates. Governor John Kasich did what he needed to do last night. All he could do, he won his home state of Ohio, took all 66 delegates, and on a night when the only other party acceptable alternative to Donald Trump dropped out, down in Florida, Kasich has set about preparing for intricate behind-the-scenes maneuvering at the GOP convention in Cleveland in July. Joining me now, Neeraj Antani. He's a delegate for Kasich and a representative in the Ohio House of Representatives. Neeraj, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
There's no doubt, of course, if we look at cold hard math, that the path to the nomination is essentially non-existent for John Kasich right now, barring a contested convention. So talk about the road ahead, why John Kasich should stay in, and really what role you think he can play at this point.
Sure. Well, we really believe that at this point it has to become a two-way race between John Kasich and Donald Trump. And we need to give the American people a choice between someone who has a positive vision for the country that will move our country forward with a conservative vision and who has the record to govern, or someone who doesn't have any experience on governing the country or a state or any major government entity, and someone who hasn't been a conservative in the past. And so really, you know, I think when the American people are given that clear contrast of a choice between John Kasich and Mr. Trump, that they will choose John Kasich.
Right.
And, you know, if we get to a contested convention, you know, I do not see the delegates going to Mr. Trump, but rather aligning behind someone more like John Kasich.
Representative Antani, there is no world where there's a two-way race between John Kasich and Donald Trump, because Texas Senator Ted Cruz, the conservative, is in a healthy second place. He's not going anywhere, and he's the one who wants a two-way race with Donald Trump, and frankly is in a much, much better position to get it.
Well, I mean, I think in the minds of the American people, it has to become a contrast between, you know, Mr. Trump and John Kasich. And, you know, I think if we get to a contested convention, you know, that will be the choice. You know, so I think that's probably where we're at and probably where we're going to go.
It is Cleveland where the Republican convention heads in July. Neeraj Antani, you're really forecasting the fact that Republicans are likely now, not for sure, but likely headed toward a contested convention. And Kasich is ready for that, despite what it might do to the party.
Even if Donald Trump, you know, right now, who has the most delegates, were to get to that magic number, he would have to win, you know, 58-60% of each state from now. And he's only been getting in the low to mid 40s. And so really, at this point, I think that we're going to have a contested convention, and we need a unifying conservative nominee who can beat a Democrat in the fall and govern as president. And I think that that is John Kasich. And I think we're going to nominate him at the convention in his home state in Cleveland this July.
There is some chaos and a potential melee in the future of the Republican Party toward a July convention. Neeraj Antani thinks that his candidate, John Kasich of Ohio, the governor, is going to be the last man standing after that chaos. Neeraj Antani is a representative at the 42nd District in the Ohio House. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org.
We continued to gain delegates and continue our march to 1,237. Only two campaigns have a plausible path to the nomination, ours and Donald Trump's.
Nobody else has any mathematical possibility whatsoever.
You come the night, cause you're the cruiser, and you never get enough when you're cruising down the street.
Senator Ted Cruz has cast himself as the only Republican who can beat Donald Trump. With Marco Rubio falling away, Cruz had hoped to make that point more sharply than ever last night. But Ted Cruz picked up no wins on the electoral map. Can Cruz show his party that he has the power to defeat Donald Trump with conservatives, Christians, and constitutionalists behind him? Dr. Delbert Scott was both the Republican state senator and state representative in Missouri. He's currently president of Kansas Christian College and a Ted Cruz supporter. Dr. Delbert Scott, welcome to The Takeaway.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
A tough night overall for Ted Cruz. Your home state of Missouri was crucial for him, and he had a narrow loss.
Yes, just barely, it looks like, and they're still counting votes, but I don't see any way that he can make it up. And he did need Missouri, as well as some other states, to press forward.
Talk about the importance of the dwindling field here. Marco Rubio is out. Ted Cruz has said all along that he wants a two-way race between him and Donald Trump. Of course, John Kasich is still very much in the race, especially as we look forward to the possibility of a contested convention. But talk about the dynamics of the dwindling field and Ted Cruz versus Trump here.
Certainly, I think the message is that there are a lot of people unhappy with the way things are now. And when you had a really broad field, the dissent was spread over a wide area and nobody could get traction. Certainly with Senator Cruz, he's a great conservative voice. But the possibility of pressing ahead at this point in a successful attempt to get the number of votes is pretty dramatically difficult.
So you sound pessimistic about Cruz's ability to get enough delegates. What do you think is the future for him in this primary?
Well, I think the voice of Ted Cruz's people and the voice of dissent around America has to be voiced. And the Christian voice particularly, I think, is one that has to be heard in the discussion. It's obvious he's not going to be the nominee, but our voice needs to be heard, and that's why we're behind him and encouraging others to be.
If it's obvious that Senator Cruz isn't going to be the nominee, who do you think that person will be?
I think the way the numbers are lining up now, it's going to be Donald Trump. And in a time with loud voices dominating the debate, I think the one thing Ted Cruz can do is be the voice of reason in the discussion as we move forward.
Also today, news from Washington, Dr. Delbert Scott, of course, that the president is nominating a Supreme Court nominee. Talk about the importance of an open seat on a Supreme Court to conservatives like you and how you think it's going to shape this race.
I think it's very important. And certainly across the years, the court has been pretty balanced. It's really important for the conservative voice to have an additional replacement on the court. And it really boils down to what we're going to be in the future. And I don't think we can overemphasize the impact of our culture in the future as we move ahead on who the new Supreme Court justice is.
If Donald Trump is the nominee, do you think that conservative Christians like you need to find a home in another party or start one of their own?
No, I don't think you need to jump to another party or start another one. You need to make sure that your voice is heard and you're part of the dialogue. Donald Trump may get the nomination. Very likely he will. Donald Trump may make a great president. I think the thing about Ted Cruz is he's been a consistent conservative voice where nobody knows what Donald Trump is going to do. We all know that just he's angry and he brings out the anger in people. And that's a pretty shaky platform to move forward with.
Dr. Delbert Scott, president of Kansas Christian College, a supporter of Ted Cruz, who says it looks obvious to him that Ted Cruz can't win the Republican nomination. Dr. Delbert Scott, thank you so much for your time.
It's been a pleasure. Have a great day.
We are moving closer to securing the Democratic Party nomination and winning this election in November.
My name is Charmaine. I am a first-time presidential voter from Massachusetts.
if I were advising Hillary Clinton, I would ask her to reach out to Bernie and to Bernie fans. The Republicans cannot be allowed to have the White House in November, and Democrats need to pull together with that thought in mind.
More advice from you as we ask you to play political consultant to the candidates all hour long here on The Takeaway. Secretary Hillary Clinton did add 326 delegates to her lead last night with wins in Florida, North Carolina, Illinois, and the bellwether state of Ohio. And afterward, Clinton forecast a shift to the general election, calling out Donald Trump on his policies.
When we hear a candidate for president call for rounding up 12 million immigrants, banning all Muslims from entering the United States, when he embraces torture, that doesn't make him strong. It makes him wrong.
There's Secretary Clinton speaking last night from West Palm Beach after her big win in Florida. So what do the results mean for the Democratic primary? And as Clinton's lead increases, what can we see about the way she could go head-to-head with Donald Trump or another Republican? For instance, how is she going to appeal to voters in all important Ohio? Paula Hicks Hudson is the mayor of Toledo, Ohio, a Hillary Clinton supporter. She joins us from WGTE in Toledo. Mayor Hicks Hudson, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
I know you're a Hillary supporter, but I will ask you if you're starting to sense a nearing inevitability for her nomination.
I do. I was a little worried going into yesterday's primary, but now with the results, I'm feeling more confident that she will be our standard bearer for our party.
As the Sanders campaign, you know, says that they're not backing down, they're going to continue in this campaign. Do you have concerns that other Democrats share that a protracted campaign, Sanders is well-funded, ultimately could weaken Hillary Clinton in the general? Or are you a Democrat who thinks it's still quite healthy, it doesn't hurt her, it gets more people interested in the race?
I think it's the latter. I think we have to have a healthy debate. We have to really show what our party stands for and that we can have differing opinions, but do it in a civil manner and really flesh out those differences so that voters will truly understand what it means to be a Democrat in this time in our country.
Let's talk about the prospects of the general election a little bit. There was an ad that's gotten over a million views on YouTube already, a Republican super PAC ad where women in their own voices read some misogynistic and mean statements about women from Donald Trump. And everybody says, well, this is the theme for the general election. This is going to be a Democratic ad in some form. You've seen the ad?
I've seen bits and pieces of it. I don't think that that is our ad or what we should be talking about. The Democratic Party is a party that is inclusive and is respectful, no doubt about it, of all different people. But I think folks want to hear and voters want to know, where do you stand on issues that are going to make our lives better? How are you going to improve our economy? How are you going to make it so that a person can make a living wage and be able to take care of their family? How are we going to deal with the issue of education and post-secondary education so that folks are trained and can and then be able to make those types of living wages and things that are so critical for us to have a healthy economy?
So let's talk Ohio. You're the mayor of Toledo. Hillary Clinton had a big win there last night, as we mentioned. Some doubt about that after the upset that Bernie Sanders pulled off in Michigan, and these two states have similar economies, similar concerns. There's just no doubt that Bernie Sanders has pulled Hillary Clinton to the left on issues that a state like Ohio cares about. Trade, Trans-Pacific Partnership, Keystone Pipeline, constraints on corporations. Hillary Clinton has moved left on all of these things. Does she need to do that to stay relevant in Ohio?
I think so. I mean, and I'll speak primarily about Northwest Ohio. We are we're a Rust Belt area and closely tied to the automobile industry. And so when you have policies that hurt those types of industries, we need someone who can help, you know, bring us back and help to heal what has been lost. And when you talk about carrying on some of the policies that President Obama did, that resonates with us here in Northwest Ohio because, again, we are looking at ways in which our families are able to be supported and to take care of ourselves.
What are you hearing from Bernie Sanders supporters around your neighborhoods and around your city, however, about their willingness to support Hillary Clinton and what Sanders might have to do under the presumption here? And it is only a presumption that she may be running in a general in Ohio.
And I think what we have to do is find that common ground. One of the things that I noticed was that the difference between who the supporters are. These are a group of young, passionate folks who care about those issues, and we have to show them ways in which that their voices will be heard and will be part of the national dialogue, and not that they're going to be marginalized or put outside because one candidate won over the other. And I do think that the fact that with Senator Sanders in the race, it has moved Hillary further left. And that, I think, is a good thing for us because we have to show that we are willing to accept folks who come in as refugees. That's what this country was founded on.
There's a local issue in Ohio that's also a national issue that I want to ask you about.
Okay.
Tim McGinty, the Cuyahoga County prosecutor, the one who decided not to prosecute police after the shooting of Tamir Rice in Cleveland, lost re-election last night.
I think it shows how deeply we have to have a justice system that is really truly justice for all and not looking at maybe the very technical aspects of something. The whole issue in Cleveland, you know, I'm looking at it from afar, but I am also a lawyer and I'm a former prosecutor. So I understand how one can get an indictment or one doesn't get an indictment. And I think the very fact that there has not been an ability for a true full hearing of that particular situation shows how the voters felt in Cleveland about that.
Paula Hicks Hudson, the mayor of Toledo, Ohio, thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org. And from Staples, with printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals at Staples Stores or Staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
The world pays attention to what we say and what we do. And this is also about what we are teaching our children. We should not have to explain to them this darker side of politics. We should not be afraid to take them to a political rally or let them watch political debates. We should be teaching them that this democracy is a vibrant and precious thing, and it's going to be theirs someday. And we want them to elevate it.
There's the president speaking yesterday at the White House, responding to the recent uptick in violent rhetoric and violence that has followed some or mainly one of the presidential candidates on the campaign trail. And while the facade of this election cycle has appeared brash and crude and overly bold, some would suggest that the meat and potatoes of the race has been substantive, that democracy is at work, in which unconventional populist candidates like Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders rise to the top of the food chain upon a wave of engaged American support, that this is exactly how the system is supposed to work. Jeffrey Frank is a former senior editor of The New Yorker, and he joins me now in the studio. Jeffrey Frank, welcome.
Hi, nice to be here.
And we thought that this was a great time to look at the health of our democracy, and you could view it one of two ways, that some of the ugliness on the campaign trail, some of the apparent efforts that candidates and lawmakers have been undertaking to close off the steam valves of the democracy, make it very unhealthy. On the other hand, the issues are being aired, and if people are angry, the campaign should be angry.
Right. I mean, I think our democracy is certainly working. But what's so interesting about it is I'm not sure who's actually chosen these candidates. Mrs. Clinton basically chose herself, and the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, didn't really invite many other people to take part. On the Republican side, it's really interesting that the campaign was limited to these right-wing candidates, even by today's standards, except for the Ohio Governor John Kasich and Jeb Bush. But the selection has narrowed, and what that says about our democracy, I don't know. People are voting, which is extraordinary, I mean, in great numbers, but what they're voting for is going to take a long time to figure out.
What about the tone of the campaign? Again, many of us are disappointed, turned off. The president expressing his concern over the tone of the campaign. And there is the counter argument, as scary as it can be, that if millions of Americans are feeling this way, that this is the function of politics, to air it, not punch people in the face. In no way do I endorse that, but that this is one of the functions of politics, to air out that grievance.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are many tones in the campaign. I mean, people, I mean, actually three populists. I think Ted Cruz is a populist too. He's mining something else. But Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders are the two real populists in the campaign, and they stand for very different things. Bernie Sanders' message couldn't be clearer. You're not being paid enough. You're working too hard, you've fallen back, and above all, the system is rigged against you. He uses the word rigged, and his point is that your wages haven't improved very much, and yet people who don't make anything except more money. In other words, he's not talking about the Bill Gateses or the Jeff Bezoses. He's talking about people who do nothing but play with money, and they're making billions of dollars, and that gets people angry, and that's his message. Donald Trump's message is very different. Basically, nothing's working, we're dumb, we're not going on. He's not very clear about it. Often he doesn't make a lot of sense, but he's a very entertaining performer, and he always has been, and his message is, things are rotten, I'm going to fix it. And that's a powerful message too for people who are unhappy and think that things are rotten. But they're very different messages.
And I always have to view this also. There is a presidential campaign. We get focused on that. But that doesn't happen in a vacuum. We're also on the heels of years and years of very, very bitter, dysfunctional congressional and presidential politics. Gridlock, shutdown, debt limit, Republican on Republican political violence, right. Frankly. So this hasn't happened because of last week. I mean, this has
been...
Oh,
no.
Yeah.
No, it's been a constant story. You could almost say, I mean, certainly since the 1964 campaign with Johnson and Goldwater, where the Republican Party split briefly apart and then came back together with Richard Nixon for better or worse. No, this is an ongoing thing. And the on the other side, there's been this Gallup poll showing that President Obama gets more and more popular. His calm voice, you heard it just a few minutes ago as he talked about the campaign. And that speaks to something in the American electorate too. And I think if you want to look hopefully at it, it's that. It's that we are this calm, reasoned voice, and who is polling now above 50%, which is pretty good. For example, when Harry Truman left office, he was polling at about 22%.
Right, but 50%.
51%.
Okay.
So, I would say the 50% is the new 60.
Okay. Well, but a 50% approval rating also means a 50% unapproval if you discount the people who aren't responding.
No, it's 50. I think it's like 51 and then 37. And
okay.
Then, okay, so
fair enough. Okay. But there is also a concern, and I want to know what you think about this idea from Republican land. That if they don't have a cleansing election, if they nominate a Donald Trump or some other candidate that comes out of the convention that doesn't have an object lesson for Republicans about nominating staunch conservatives or getting rid of some of the oppositionalism and ugliness that many of them think is in their party, that this will simply continue.
Yeah, I think that's always been the case. The Republicans were always, historically, they've always said, oh, if you just give us the conservative candidate, we'll show you. They tried in 52 when they wanted to nominate Robert Taft. Then this interloper, General Eisenhower, came in and took the nomination. They finally got their wish in 64, and well, there was a great landslide. 64 has certain resemblances to today because the Republican was portrayed as a completely terrifying, inexperienced candidate, even though Barry Goldwater was a man of great principle and decency. But the Democrat was completely distrusted. People thought that Johnson was a crook. His chief aide, a guy named Bobby Baker, was just this side of jail, and I think he went to jail finally. And if President Kennedy hadn't been shot, Johnson, who knows what might have happened to Lyndon Johnson? People knew this. So I'm not saying that it's exactly the same, and people don't think Hillary Clinton's a crook, but there's really a distrust on that side, and Lord knows what people finally think of Donald Trump. His views are so unclear, and his trust level is so low. He's at 27% of trustworthiness. Hillary Clinton's at 37%.
All right. So before we go, diagnosis, American democracy limping, okay, sprained.
Sprained. Yeah. Sprained is my word. Not broken, but sprained, and sprains do heal.
Sprains do heal. You need to stay off of them for a while. We're not going to get that chance, unfortunately.
Right, but they also recur because your ankle is still weak.
Jeffrey Frank is a former senior editor at The New Yorker. He's author of Ike and Dick, A Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Well, indeed, it is time to put some weight right back on that strain. Judge Merrick Garland is President Obama's nominee for the Supreme Court. 63 years old, a Chicago native, he's the chief judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, where he's served since 1997.
Fidelity to the Constitution and the law has been the cornerstone of my professional life. And it's the hallmark of the kind of judge I have tried to be for the past 18 years. If the Senate sees fit to confirm me to the position for which I have been nominated today, I promise to continue on that course.
Well, Merrick Garland is now headed to the Senate, and I am too. John Hockenberry is on his way back tomorrow. Me, back to Washington, where the ultimate political fight is now underway. Mitch McConnell and the Senate Republicans, they're doing their best to avoid a divisive ideological fight they think they can't win. Not in a year with Donald Trump and Ted Cruz running for president, a possibly chaotic convention, and senator after Republican senator trying to survive re-election. It'll be fascinating to see which GOP senators toe McConnell's line and which ones decide their best chance of staying elected is to be seen as at least giving Merrick Garland the time of day. Well, for everything else he is, judge, lawyer, Merrick Garland just turned into the ultimate political weapon. Democrats' nuclear option? It could come to that. Supreme Court fights are most important in the bases of the parties. Think about it. Abortion, guns, gay rights, civil rights, detainees. It's going to be a wild spring and summer. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.